are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, December 22nd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, history professor, Vanderbilt University, Jane Landers, on the history of Cuba that has led us to this, nearly this point of dropping the embargo. Well, we're still a ways off, but of normalized relations. Also on the program today, two New York Police Department killed. Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, over the weekend, assassinated, essentially just come upon by a crazed killer. And some police officials, specifically some of the heads of the unions, are using this as an opportunity to bash those who are protesting for justice in the case of Eric Garner or in Michael Brown. They are attacking the Mayor de Blasio, Rudy Giuliani taking the opportunity to attack President Obama. It's unbelievable, really. And frankly, I think they're doing themselves a huge disservice. This is not 1992. But we will get into that. Meanwhile, speaking of Ferguson, the DA in Ferguson, Missouri, or really, I guess, in Missouri, McCullough, admits that he knew Witness 40 was lying. Witness 40, the most, perhaps the single most referenced witness in any discussions of that grand jury. He claims now he knew that she was lying, but wanted to let everybody go in there. Stunning. Meanwhile, the CIA's, I'm going to try and say this with a straight face, accountability board says, overrules their internal inspector generals and says there's really going to be no accountability for our spying on the Senate. Since we've gotten away with just about everything else, let's just make this a clean sweep, shall we? New York Times calls for a prosecution of the torturers. Kansas looks like they're going to have bigger problems than they had even 6 months ago. It'll be interesting to see now that Brownback has been reelected whether or not he'll be able to deal with that. We got some other stories in the hopper as well. Folks, just a little bit of housekeeping, cleaning? Keeping it clean. The house is what we're trying to do. We will be live tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, we will have two interviews that you have not have heard. Ones I did for Ring of Fire Radio last week. And then on Friday, we will run an interview that I'm recording today with the great Digby. So you will have new content this week, except for on Christmas Day. And, you know, go back and listen to an old episode on Christmas Day that you missed. Surely you missed one.
That's the Majority Report saying bah humbug.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to leave a thing of coal for you in your stocking. I don't know what a thing of coal, a briquette of coal, or just a piece of coal, I guess it is. Then all next week, 5 days. 5 days, right?
5 days.
So we're going to do five best ofs.
Five best ofs.
We really were looking at how much best of material we had, and we thought we may need to do like 30 best ofs. So in the next like 20, really in the next like 4 or 5 hours, I guess, if you send us another suggestion for the best of, we will put it into the mix.
We will take your last minute best of suggestions, but today only, folks.
That's right. And so, and then we'll have best ofs, and then we'll be back live on the 5th. I've noticed a lot of radio show hosts, they took off today and tomorrow. Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
Now, the producers are still working, obviously, because there's another host. So, you're welcome, guys. And I'm talking to Matt and Mike.
Well, we could always host.
Well,
psych.
I don't want to do that. We're already leaving the thing of coal on Wednesday. All right, lumps of coal. Lumps of coal, I am told. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Professor Jane Landers. All right, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of History at Vanderbilt University, Jane Landers. Jane, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Sam.
Sorry about that. So let's start with the just where we're at now. The president has basically begun the process of normalizing relations. The embargo, of course, is statutory and can only be changed by Congress. But just give us a brief a sense of how big of a deal this is.
Well, you know, it's huge. It's been long overdue in a lot of people's opinion, including mine. It really hasn't functioned, as many people have already pointed out. The many times I've been to Cuba, the people who are connected somehow to the government are not really withdrawn as much from the economy as others. And when I go out into the countryside, you can see the vast difference in living standards in Havana and in the country. So embargo works against the very most vulnerable people who are not related to officialdom. And I just don't think it works. And there's all sorts of goods to be had. Things come in all the time from other places. And
well, so that's the thing that people forget, I think, is that it's just the U.S.
That's right. That's right. You know, for a long time, Spain has been heavily involved in building hotels for the tourists from Europe and from Latin America and helping in other ways as well with financial support. Venezuela used to be quite a big assistance to Cuba when there was sufficient oil revenue, and under Chavez that was quite the case. It was an exchange of medical knowledge and doctors from Cuba for the oil supports from Venezuela, and that also helped sustain a really broken economy. And now, you know, there's really not as much support except from tourism, and so it's just unevenly distributed as well. So I just really don't think the embargo is functioning.
Now, I want to get to a couple of points that I know that you have some specific expertise in, particularly this special time. But before we get there, I mean, isn't the point of in terms of the embargo, I mean, it's quite clear. If something's not working for 50-some-odd years, right. There's no reason to believe that it's going to continue to work. And there's obviously there seems to be multiple constituencies here who have a vested interest. We have things like agribusiness in this country who – and probably, you know, I don't know what you call them, tourism industries who want to get into Cuba. There's potential consumers there for all sorts of our products. There's obviously the Cuban people themselves, like you say, who have been hurt by this embargo, you know, because the U.S. is obviously the biggest is the biggest sort of economic power, you know, within miles of them.
Right.
It also seems to me, and aside from sort of the individual, we have sort of the older Cubans, people who had a vested interest, and I mean a dollar interest. In Cuba, at the time of the revolution, of Castro's ascension, it seems to me their theory all along, and I would include in this would be the corporations who have several billions of dollars worth of claims in Cuba, least according to them, that they want a catastrophic failure of Cuba because that's the best chance for them to come in and have outside forces sort of dictate who gets their claims reinstated. Is that basically the way it works?
Well, I can't really speak for the corporate interests who have these plans, but I wouldn't doubt it. I just think there's got to be a better way to handle things. And the corporate interests are really not the ones that I'm the most concerned about, frankly. There were all sorts of uneven deals during the Batista years, as there were in all the dictatorships we supported around Latin America, where the privileged few got benefits and were able to do startup companies and make wonderful profits exterior to Cuba. But I'm not really so interested in their restoration of rights as much as having freedom of the press, having freedom of movement, having internet connections for the people, and of course, to be able to sustain the health conditions and education that are at least one of the, or two, I guess should say, of the, the things that did work well in Cuba. Fortunately, we've lifted some restrictions on medicines and on food, and that's been a big help to get people through things like, you know, the damage done by the special period. But I know there are, you know, people who lost private homes and so on as well, and I'd be more concerned about those, but all in all, I think that's not the priority here.
So let's talk about the special period. I tend to agree with you, and I also, actually, before we get to the special period, you know, I mean, I think on this audience, certainly, I think is primarily on the left, and in the main, there has been at different times a on the left a romanticizing of the Castro regime and era, and having visited once myself, I think I came back with a little bit more of a sober analysis of
what year
it's
was
like.
It you visited, Sam?
I was there in 2002, and and so people were just, you know, we're still sort of talking about the special period, but it had clearly ended. So both give us a sense of like, of through time, through the years of Castro, just sort of, you know, what was and what has been the life for the average Cuban? What was the average Cuban sort of, I guess, perspective on these things?
Well, you know, the first time I actually went was exactly when the special period began. I was there for a research project. It was under the Soviet Union's control at that time. And I was handled by government drivers and so on. Everything was safe and secure because nobody dared do otherwise. And there was, as I said, an infusion of Soviet money and oil to help the economy, which was pretty much just tourism and sugar at that point. And as sugar collapsed on the economy, that wasn't helping either. but at least things were stable. There were, you know, housing going up, health care provided for everybody. There were schools and so on. There were also committees for the defense of the revolution on every block where people were encouraged to spy and tell on others if they were doing something that the government didn't approve of and so on. And I wanted a socialist revolution to help, but it was corrupted almost from the beginning. And so then we acted stupidly in not trying to get in on the ground floor and help Castro. So problems on both sides, blame on both sides, but the people are the ones that have really suffered. And in that special period...
Tell us when it was that first time that you were there and experienced those things, and then explain to us what the special period means.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was there in 1991, and the first time as a graduate student. And what followed after the collapse of the Soviet Union was that there was no more foreign oil coming in, which had helped sustain prices at low levels, which allowed the rationing of food in equal measure and so on. And after they pulled out, things got really bad. And there was no fuel. There was little food being brought in from the countryside because everything had been transformed into sugar. And I remember, donkey carts bringing big, loads of bananas might be the only thing we'd eat in even the shabby tourist hotels where we were. Water would be brought in big tanks on trucks to be piped into really horrible water systems, and decaying infrastructure was pretty much a problem even then. So it was very hard, and people didn't have enough to eat. The elderly, the weak, and the children, are the most vulnerable in all those situations. And you may remember that there were even sort of vitamin deficiency blindnesses happening and so on. So the special period is a very difficult one where people were just suffering. I was not able to get out into the countryside in that time period. Well, actually, I'm sorry, I was, but I was under the drivers that were taking me and so on, so I didn't get to see anything but what they really wanted me to see. Later, I was able to, go out and do research projects that I have been running for all this time, and saw what was different about small towns out in the countryside. The one I have visited over 20 years now is Ceiba Mocha, which used to be called San Agustin de la Nueva Florida, and it was a resettlement of Florida exiles to Cuba in 1762. So I've been working on that. And I was there most recently back again in May and saw, time is frozen there. There are Russian tractors still work in the fields. The old cars that everybody thinks are so romantic, but which are the only, thing they've got going. A lot of donkey carts and mules and so on, still keeping people mobile to a certain degree. So it's as if time froze in the countryside, and yet Havana was looking really pretty sparkly with new hotels and some internet.
Well, I want to stay in the special period for a moment, because I mean this is one of the things that I think struck me when I was there, is that in this country you never the implications of the fall of the Soviet Union were all almost exclusively reported in the context of obviously the former Soviet Union and then the Eastern European countries. Right. And at that time, I remember hearing nothing about what was happening in Cuba, but it was just they fell off a cliff, basically, right? So just give us a little bit more of just what it meant. I mean, how quickly that process happened and how great was the deprivation? And also, to what extent, if you have any sense, of what it did to the national psyche? Because the people I spoke to, it was just this massive betrayal of it felt like a huge betrayal to them, I think. Curious as to your sense of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's very schizophrenic, as you probably saw. So you're surrounded all the time by walls painted with revolutionary slogans, by billboards that still look back to the heroes Che and Fidel and Camilo. And, the revolution will succeed and all of this and, support for the patria. So all around there is, everywhere you look, as you probably saw, are these exhortations to come to the defense of the revolution. But behind the scenes, people, the normal people who are suffering because they can't get what they need, or their families have been divided because others took the risks and went on the balsas, you know, the Balsero people who floated to Miami, basically. So families divided, poverty, terrible housing, lack of infrastructure, all those things are horrible to have to live with, and to be assigned to live certain places, to not be able to travel in your own country, go to your own beaches, take your own vacations wherever. So the people that were beginning to be critical, you may have seen that when they're talking in that way, they used to make a little motion where they stroked an invisible beard to poke fun at Fidel and the failures of the revolution. But it wasn't always a joke. There were, you know, there could be important consequences if you were too visible, if you marched for some reason, if you tried to take a boat and escape across the bay from Regla, they sunk boats, they imprisoned people. So the revolutionary fervor was good for those who were still being supported by the revolution, and the average people were much more critical, privately and quietly.
Talk a little bit too about the foreign policy of Cuba. I mean, there was their involvement in places like Mozambique and Angola, mm-hmm. and South Africa, mm-hmm. and how yeah. much of that was enabled by their support. I think it's quite clear when you look at like sort of the special period and what predated that, just how much support they were getting from the Soviet Union, and how much that allowed them to do what they were doing.
Right. They would have had no way to do that otherwise. I mean, there was a tremendous investment. I'm more familiar with what was going on in Angola, and I've actually talked to people who came back from Angola who had been part of the revolution. One is a woman who was given a home right there on the main pathway to the sea in Havana, and was given a home in which she opened a very wonderful paladar, a private restaurant. All around the walls are the skulls of animals that she shot herself in Angola as a soldier, pictures of her in combat gear in Angola. And at some point, she was actually wounded, brought back, celebrated, and then had to serve another term in Angola. So you still talk to people like that who, if they benefited from those adventures, are still loyal. But others lost their sons, and we'll never know really how many people died in Angola.
For listeners who may be too young to recall or were not aware of just exactly what Cuba did, what was their role in Angola, and how did that come about?
Castro, as soon as he had his revolution secured, and he thought it was secure, and many people were still rooting for him all along, they felt an ideological responsibility to spread the system where they could. And so he took on the role of the leader of the Third World. So there was a tremendous amount of press campaign on his part. He would be received in these capitals and feted. And he really, I'm sure, seriously believed in all of it. And so did many of the people that went and died there. So as a responsible a leader of the Third World, he thought the spread was up to him. And so you had the adventures in Angola, Mozambique. You had Che going, eventually supposedly renouncing his role in Cuba so that none of the backlash would fall on Fidel when he went to Bolivia. And so the revolution was supposed to spread, but there was no way that Cuba on its own could have done that. They didn't have the manufacturing capability at that point, and they couldn't have supported it financially. So I think a lot of that was, again, support that could have gone to the Cuban people, and it was spent outside, basically.
Give me a sense, too. One thing that struck me when I was there was this disparity between the city and the country.
You saw it, too.
Well, I mean, to a certain extent. I mean, we spent most of our time in and around Havana, but we went out to the country. But one of the things that I did understand was that the vast majority of the people on the police force in Havana were from the country, and that this dynamic was exploited. Give us a sense of of what's behind that, and as we see the normalization process take hold, and assuming that we are at least maybe a year, maybe 2 years, who knows, away from the sort of the embargo beginning to sort of really finally crumble. What do we anticipate happening with that disparity and just the country in general?
Well, since you mentioned going out into the countryside and the connection of the police to the mainstream, it's true there's always in the Latin world been a corporate entity for the civil and military police. Sometimes there are several different branches of police, military always ranking higher. In Cuba, you may have noticed the different colored uniforms, so they rank from just sort of low-level, you know, people helping the tourists across the street kind of people to the scarier guys in the black uniforms with heavy weaponry and that sort of thing. But policing is one of the things that has a very long corporate sense to it in Latin America, and it is a way of building loyalty to the state because those people at least have a regular salary. They're protected from civil courts. The families can benefit in that way as well. So I think that's a pretty historic pattern actually all over Latin America. And military people are often the ones appointed to all the state jobs where there will be a salary, including places you wouldn't expect them, like historical institutes or cultural institutes where really they haven't the training for it. But when you mentioned the countryside and attempting to get the loyalty in, we were talking a minute ago about the special period. During some of the trips there, when I did go to the countryside, there was absolutely no meat to be had. The government controlled whether or not you could kill cows. There were no cats, as you may remember, or dogs in the street anymore. I've really noticed some improvement in the last couple of years, and more fields planted and more animals that I see out in the fields, too, goats and some cows and some horses. So it looks like some things are improving in the countryside, but still not.
What do you think accounts for that? I mean, is it simply that technology has gotten better, that the countries in Central America have become stronger economically, and so there's more opportunity? What accounts for the improvements? I mean, I guess this is all, you know, even though, you know, we're talking now 15 or 20 years, I guess, since the end of their full dependence on the Soviet Union and being cut off, I guess on some level, what we're seeing is the their ability to actually forge a new path.
Well, I think, you know, what has made the difference probably in these last couple of years is somehow the money from tourism coming into at least some state-run improvements out in the countryside. I noticed roads were better, walls were restored, as I said, more planting and more animal husbandry. But when I mentioned it to the people of the small town where I was working, they said, oh, but that's right along the highway where the tourist buses are going to go that you'll see these kinds of things. So there's a certain amount of theater to some of the improvements that still haven't, you know, helped the mainstream, and the same people were still resorting to hunting for food and that sort of thing, even though I thought things looked a lot better.
It's interesting because that's also, you know, the Cuban regime has always had made a practice for the most part of giving people like artists and cultural figures much more leeway so that they could project out to the rest of the world that things might be a little bit freer and a little bit better than in home. What about health and education? To the extent that we have perceptions that they have a fairly, relatively speaking, robust health and education systems, how real are those accomplishments?
Well, you know, they certainly are. The training for medical personnel in Cuba was excellent, and education became, you know, totally accessible for everybody. But even in the early 90s, when I was there talking with people. Some of them were trying, some of the school teachers were trying to get out because they were under tremendous amount of pressure to, which happens everywhere. Grade inflation was a problem, and dumbing down the curriculum to make it, you know, look more successful. But everybody got it, and so I don't want to, you know, take away from what really was a wonderful success that people were finally allowed to have it, and also the health care, and at least rationed food. And so there was a certain base level of support for everybody. And, you know, Brigade built housing, which was terribly horrible, but it gave people housing, and it gave people a sense that they were building a new state. So all of those things are great. But then when you don't have any medicine anymore coming in, and the wonderfully trained doctors are there with nothing to work with,
right,
then you certainly wouldn't want to be in one of the hospitals. And I remember people coming in from the Bahamas with their own anesthesia and supplies to have wonderful surgeries done in Cuba, but they had to provide a lot of what they needed.
So Bahamian citizens would come to Cuba with their own medical supplies, and basically,
well,
just so that they could use the
doctors?
I don't
know that they were Bahamians, but
right,
they were coming on planes from the Bahamas and talking about what they were going to get done in Cuba. So it became a place where wonderful medical care was available, but not the supplies for it.
Tell us also about the Brigade housing, because I'm not sure that people understand that concept, and whether or not that is, like I say, I haven't, I went there once, and that was almost 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Is that process of building houses or apartment complexes, is that continued? Do we see abandoned projects around?
Yeah.
Or?
I don't see it happening anymore, but the remnants of them are still everywhere, including in sort of relocated villages that the state tried to move people to the countryside during this special period, exactly for the reasons that there were overcrowding in the city and it was hard to get food in and that sort of thing. And so some of the places are just sort of in unusual spots out in the countryside. A very successful, or a pretty successful one, was a place called Las Terrazas, the Terraces, that was a reforestation project the state started out in the countryside, moved everybody out there, created some housing for them. They planted trees, which are now beautifully big. There's a beautiful lake there, and it's now become sort of an eco-tourist spot to go to with even one little lodge to stay in. The people are generations there, some artists, but mostly people who worked in agriculture and reforestation. But one of the people I met there had been a French teacher in the capital, didn't really want to move there, but there was no other way at that point. And now she's one of the people that helps tourists see the place and answers questions. They're still on their ration cards out there, but there's a school, and it's really a pretty place to be. It may not have been a choice, but it's pretty now.
And I don't know that people understand. I mean, we should say that these Brigade housing, basically you build your own apartment complex.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, and so in the city, it's not so pretty, those places, and they are, you know, what you might consider brutalist architecture of the Soviet era, just the simplest forms of blocks of housing. But people not trained in any sort of way would have to work on building these. Not have to, they were encouraged, and it was a civic effort. And they would build a lot of cheap housing into which people could go. And so the older colonial houses that were in this city, the heart of the city, that had been occupied by everybody who was homeless, many, many families worth, were often moved back into these brand new Soviet-built housing by the people under the Soviet regime, I should say. And then the beautiful old colonial homes around the squares that you probably saw became artists' workshops and places that tourists could go and buy approved art and that sort of thing. And so you saw a big transformation in the early 90s when UNESCO went in and saved some of the old buildings, designated Havana a World Heritage Site and that sort of thing. But so the brutalist housing was better than no housing, and it still survives and doesn't look as bad in the countryside, but You know, it wasn't as if anybody got any possibility to design their own style of living.
So what do you anticipate happening now? I mean, is it a, you know, assuming that these small sort of like foot in the door, if you will, greater sort of connections, a recognition of a formal recognition of the existence of each other, essentially. What do you anticipate happening in the years to come, assuming that this is slowly begins to crumble the embargo?
Well, you know, I hope that it'll just be more open for everybody. It's already gotten so much better for families to go back and forth. And so you may have seen also in Miami, the people that made the trips to visit all their relatives in the U.S. would go back to Cuba loaded with everything from, you know, baby dolls to televisions to old auto parts wrapped in that blue plastic film that they have to use to keep everything together on the planes. And all of those remittances of material goods and money have really helped improve the situation a lot. But if you opened it totally, I think that would actually create more possibilities for small businesses and, you know, even farming and other sorts of things that take fuel and take machinery and that sort of thing that could be possibly more independent. There's some independent agriculture allowed now, as well as little restaurants and little bed and breakfast kinds of places. So the more of that that happens, I think it's easier for everybody. And I think one of the biggest needs is access to information. I know that we the U.S. distributed a lot of free telephones, little cell phones everywhere. That's one of the big things relatives want to send their families. But internet is tightly controlled, so information flows are difficult. I want to see all of that happen. And actually, we have historic relations with Cuba that go forever. And the Cubans always liked Americans as individuals, actually. They don't like our system, and that created suffering for them. And they don't understand exactly how much of it was not created by the U.S., but all of our silly misadventures of exploding cigars and that sort of thing and Operation Mongoose just allowed the government to keep us as the main problem. And I think if we remove ourselves from that, you know, image, everybody did like Americans. I actually had a friend tell me they didn't like the Soviets so much because they couldn't dance and their food was bad and they stuck to themselves, whereas they saw Americans as sort of, you know, more like them than Soviets were. And so even in the special period, I would hear Michael Jackson blasting out of places and people play baseball and discuss baseball on the squares. And so there's really this cultural affinity that we should be able to restore.
All right. And I should just tell people, too, that Operation Mongoose was another one of our plans to assassinate or Castro, or I guess another, which involved the trying to gift him a cigar that was supposed to blow up.
Yeah, I grew up in Miami, and so you would see all the boats coming up the canals to the up the very nice houses where these things were run out of on the canal systems in Miami. And you would see in the little restaurants in Calle Ocho the guys coming in from having practiced in the Everglades to join some of the expeditions, and they'd be, you know, posters all over those restaurants as well. So that's the older guard, you know, that have pretty well dominated for a long time, but the younger generation doesn't want to continue that.
Jane Landers, thanks so much for your time today.
I enjoyed it.
Professor at Vanderbilt, appreciate your speaking to us on this.
Thank you, Sam.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
All right, folks. Just one more day. Tomorrow, I'm not sure what we're going to do on the program. Maybe we'll have Matt and Isabel give us a final movie, film choices.
I would love to do that with Isabel.
And we would do it on the, you know, Matthew, film guy Matthew. We'll see. But tomorrow we'll probably just open it up, phone calls and IMs and whatnot. In the meantime, we're going to head into the a fun half of the program. We will talk about what a D-bag Rudy Giuliani is. And You know, I've talked to a historical, yeah, but I got to say that, you know, when these police benevolent association leaders come out and they say these type of things, I mean, I think I mentioned this on Friday. If this is indicative of their membership, then I think the problem is probably more widespread than people think. You know, I don't think they're doing themselves any favors. I mean, I think this is, you know, they are responding in some respects. The police department, maybe to a certain extent, the fire department. These are institutions that they're living in a different decade. I really think they are living in a different decade. When you hear what this guy has said and the claims they're making based upon in New York City, the protests have been, I mean, you can't say completely nonviolent, but on you know, to the extent that you can generalize about any of this, completely nonviolent.
Especially when you got something like 30,000 people marching in the streets.
I mean, and they are responding to violence. And I just don't think that the rest of New York City is sitting around waiting for the Police Benevolence Association to come out and say that this is de Blasio's fault and that he's got blood on his hands. I just think that when this guy talks like this, he's just so tone deaf to what people in the city are responding to. That I think he's doing a great disservice to the police force in this city. And I will say this, too. They can put out these edicts about slowing down, protecting, and not doing their jobs. And they're also hurting themselves. They simply, this is a gross miscalculation, politically speaking, from these police union leaders. They may think that they're responding to, and maybe they're right. I mean, maybe the police force is a bunch of thugs. I don't think they are. But when you hear this guy talk, he must think that's his audience. Honestly. Now, he's either too insulated and has surrounded himself with the most thuggish element of the police force, or he's basically, you know, he's doing like an SOS by blinking his eyes to the rest of us saying, hey, there's a deep-seated problem here. I can't tell you the truth because I'm the head of the Police Benevolence Association, but there's a real problem here. You should be looking into this, but I got to go back to pretending like I'm. I mean, otherwise, this is completely unexplainable. Because this guy really has no sense of how he's coming off. And, you know, they've been, well, we'll get into this all in the.
A lot to talk about in the better half.
Definitely. And
certainly not a funner half today.
This stuff out of Ferguson, it's stunning. I don't know how this district attorney, McCullough, this guy should be disbarred.
I don't think you know how the grand jury system works, Sam.
Apparently, I don't.
You regularly have people that you know are lying. Especially when it involves clearing a cop for murdering a black kid.
Look, I just wanted to make it so this was a very open process. And by open, I meant anybody can show up as long as they're willing to have a straight face when they're telling their story. That's all.
It's like a Craigslist ad.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, we got a grand jury show
open
up.
Open call.
Open casting. Are you mentally deranged and willing to back up the story of a police officer who shot a young black man? Then come. We have an open grand jury in Ferguson, Missouri.
Are you one of those folks who feel you're not getting enough attention at home? Have you ever spoken in front of a crowd? What about a grand jury? We'll be happy to take your testimony as long as it comports with something that we think will be politically viable for us. Any type of crazy bat crap story you can come with.
literally his response. Yeah, of course I knew she was lying.
Browsing for new stop and goes around town? On an egg hunt? Doesn't matter why you say you were there. Just say you were there, and what you saw comports to the story that the police officers are telling.
All right, we got to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Folks, wait. Well, wait. Look. Just wait. Give us a review on iTunes. All right? Just go and do that. Pop us up there. Come on. I should say that we had a problem where the show was not posting onto iTunes for a while. For some reason, we didn't catch it. Most people, I think, subscribe directly now and get it through different ways. But, so it's forced me to go to iTunes and see what's hot. And we're up there more often than not in the what's hot. But then I got to see these other shows, and it just drives me crazy, folks. And the reason is because they're getting reviews. So go over there. If you haven't reviewed us recently, go over there and review us again. Give us a review. And also, if, you know, of course, this time of year, very tough for people. But if you're one of those people who is not financially stressed during this time of year, but you enjoy the show, by all means, become a Majority Report member. We're going to try to do a fundraiser in January. And we're looking to raise $1.7 billion. We may have to scale back on that. If we do raise $1.7 billion, it will also probably be our last show. We'll be doing the Matt, Michael, Sam from, you know, Tulum, Mexico show or something like. Today, we had, you know, clams over whatever.
Very nice food. By the way, that guy in Ferguson should be disbarred. Okay, folks, that's the 5-minute mark.
Surf's up.
Surf's up.
Become a member today at majority.fm. Also, folks, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. If you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do to take a little piece out of Jeff Bezos is to use our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, just do the Amazon shopping if you must through there, and we get a little kickback. All right, folks, see you in the fun half.